Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. It's good and important to practice in solitude, to have viveka, especially to develop samadhi, and to have a cloistered lifestyle removed from the world, especially for the samatha aspect in our meditation. But I find, at least from time to time, it is also good to move and to see a little bit of the world, to have some exposure, to travel. In the original lifestyle at the time of the Buddha that was provided by going arms round every day into towns, cities, villages, where monks, nuns would encounter daily life. And of course, when they would be traveling, just walking along the highways all over northern India. Even nowadays, when you're on pilgrimage in India, in the remote areas, in the bus, sometimes no one is almost driving through people's living room or their lounge, and it's just right next to the road. So it's also good to have some exposure to do traveling, to use wisdom to investigate what one encounters. And I'm saying so because after the Lumpur Sumedho event 4 weeks ago, I have been traveling, seeing my father, Hanover, Berlin, then the monastery in Germany, Muttodaya, 3 nights in Chatehurst. And yesterday I've been traveling from Chatehurst to Amaravati in the train, Petersfield to Waterloo, then the tube Waterloo to Houston and the train Houston to here. It's an interesting experience to be in that crowd, to be in the tube. I was planning with plenty of space, and so I had quite a bit of time, I think almost an hour till my train left Houston, because I didn't know how long the whole thing would take getting there. And walking around and looking at people, and I was quite relaxed. I didn't have time pressure, the opposite. And noticing how people are rushing. It's called rush hour for a reason, I guess. Everyone seems to be, no, not everyone, but most people, many people, and apparently some very important thing that they have to get to, and almost running many and a distorted phase, rushing for whatever they're heading towards. Anyway, I made a note to say, because even in monastic life, that can sometimes happen, even at Dhammagibi, I try to get my office work finished in the morning, that in the afternoon I've completely free. But sometimes that is tight, and then I continue, and then I have to rush for the meal at noon, and then I may be late for the meal, for the food offering, which is embarrassing. So it was a good reminder, what are we rushing for, and if we are in the monastic life, can we not get out of that pressure, of that constant need to get anywhere? Can we settle down in a more timeless realm. Once in Australia, they got me to the international airport, dropped me off, because a more senior monk was having an international flight. And I, however, then had to make my way to the domestic part, which was quite some distance. And it wasn't really enough time. They hadn't given me really enough time with that drop off. And so I was moving beyond haste. And actually one of the Aussie workers there made fun of me. And he said, "Oh, mate, I thought you guys are the most patient ones." And I felt really embarrassed as a monk, rushing along and being admonished by the workers at the airport. It can happen. I truly admire Lumpur Liem on that one. He has this Ka Lan Yu. I have never seen him rushing. He always seems to be at ease, and he's moving gracefully. He's doing everything slow pace. But at the same time, I also don't see him being late. As an amazing combination. He's not rushing. It flows completely natural. He arrives in time. His timing is usually impeccable. And he also seems to get things done that need to be done. He seems to execute his duties and responsibilities very successfully. In my case, I often find myself rushing and then still ending up being a bit too late and sometimes feeling that I don't get it all done, even so. And I believe Lumpur Liem, I was told, he's doing that even without a watch. He doesn't even have one of these monks' watches around the belt, apparently. And of course, he doesn't have a mobile phone. Most people now check their time with a mobile phone. And he has got this instinctive, beautiful, relaxed, but precise timing. One thing that I aspire to, living the monastic life, getting out of this rush. But even more important, and what are they rushing to if they are so much under time pressure, if they distort their faces and make such a big effort in trying to get somewhere, and where are they actually trying to get? And I often felt both London yesterday or Berlin, one can almost see it in the faces of people. Now, the majority growing up in our society, there is no real goal, there's no aim in life. It's kind of pointless. And I try to remember more than 30 years ago, before I encountered the Dhamma and found a true purpose, what it was like, particularly in my late teens, without any clear point or purpose in life. What's the point of it all? What does it all mean? And feeling this tremendous sense of relief to be in a position that now, the way we live, there is actually a point, there is a aim, there is a meaning, there's something to aspire to. And even if we haven't realized it yet, so far we may only have the mug. I've got this mug from Lumpur Sumedho, which we kindly gifted to the visiting senior monks, where it says, the consciousness without feature, without end, radiant all around. Another famous Pali quote, Vijnanang Anidasanang Anantang Sapato Pabhang. Even if we haven't realized that yet, at least we have that conviction, we have found that faith that this thing can be realized, can be experienced. That freedom is actually possible, total freedom, that release, that the end of death, the deathless, exists and can be realized. And there is a path, the Noble Eightfold Path. There's a teaching of the Buddha and the Koba Ajahns describing in intricate detail, very precisely, how we can get there. And even if we may feel that we haven't made as much headway on that path as great Koba Ajahns, or not as much headway as we've been hoping for, even just being, going in that direction and having that consolation compared to being in a world via materialism is kind of the underlying philosophy. When one dies, there's just nothing. There's all these experiences one can have. But where does it lead to? Does any of that lead actually to freedom, to release, to the end of suffering, the end of death? And all these people rushing, usually not rushing towards freedom and release and the end of dukkha, but just rushing within samsara. The faster they twirl around, the more they get caught in samsara. There's a simile given by Venerable Sariputta and also Venerable Ananda of a town in the more unsafe border regions, which is heavily fortified. And then there's a skillful gatekeeper who was responsible for the whole fortification and overseeing the guards and the gate. This town has only one gate. And the gatekeeper is walking about and making sure that the wall is in good shape and safe and stable. And he knows that there's no gap in this wall, that even a smaller being like a cat could possibly walk in and out. So he knows for sure that everyone who goes in or out, every human being at least, any larger beings, going in and out of that town, have to go through that gate. There's no other way in or out. And Venerable Sariputta said similarly, all the previous Buddhas, Venerable Ananda said, all beings who find release, who free themselves from death and dukkha, they do so through this one gate, having abandoned the five hindrances, the pancha nivarana, having established their mind well in the four foundations of mindfulness, the four satipatthana, and having developed the seven factors of enlightenment, the sutta bhujanga. That is one gate where everyone has to go through in order to experience the deathless. And one feels some compassion with people who are trapped it's not even just that there's only this war, and it's almost like a labyrinth, and all these people in a city like Berlin, London. Now, what can you do a Friday evening like today? And what could you potentially do in London? How many activities, how many entertainments, how many art events, culture, music, opera, concerts, activities? This is basically endless. But virtually nothing of that leading out, nothing of that leading into this gate, not all a blind alley. It's not only that there's only one gate, but there are all these kind of blind alleys, all these dead ends with attractive advertising signs. And at the entrance it doesn't say it's a dead end, but it's highly advertised that it's really nice and entertaining and gives you a pleasant feeling. And once people go in there, and it doesn't lead to freedom or diminishing of dukkha or out of death and dukkha, but further in. And just the relief, the joy, you know, that one is on a path going out. And I think that this is the important one. Going in the right direction. And I think sometimes maybe in our meditation we can become too absorbed or maybe too obsessed with the minor details. Should I do anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath, or maybe rather buddho, or maybe combining the breath and buddho, or rather doing walking meditation, or maybe just general mindful awareness, body contemplation, or should I go maybe to Thailand or stay in Amaravati or maybe Sri Lanka? Where can I practice better? More solitude, less duties, or maybe a more challenging position and responsibility and developing in that way? And if we look at these details, but I feel it's important that occasionally we move back a little bit and ask ourselves, is the meditation going in the right direction? Like in the 16 steps, the famous tetrads the Buddha gave for anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath, the last four. Anicca anupassi asasisamiti sikati. We breathe in and out, training ourselves to contemplate impermanence. Viraga anupassi, to contemplate fading away, to contemplate dispassion. Nirodha anupassi, a contemplating cessation, an ending. Patinissaka anupassi, a contemplating letting go. We meditate to let go. These are given at the end because they are obviously the most refined, the most subtle and profound part of anapanasati, but occasionally it's good to put it at the beginning, to start meditation with the contemplation that this is all for letting go. It's a little bit like entering a train, boarding a train. There's all kinds of little decisions to make. Now, nowadays, if you have a major piece of luggage, these trains sometimes don't have a good place to put luggage. Now, we had to put the luggage. Which carriage to sit? Or do we like to sit watching in direction we are, the train is going, or the other direction, or the green seats or the blue ones, or maybe sometimes first class or second or third or whatever. But these are more details, isn't it? The crucial one is that we are in the right train to the right destination. And I think sometimes it's good to bring that awareness back and to check that out. Not just the details in our meditation, but is it going in the right direction? Is it actually going towards ending, towards dispassion? Is it towards seeing and realizing and understanding impermanence, anicca? Is it going towards letting go? And if we make that our main aspiration, then we also don't have to worry so much about doubting the little details, because it doesn't matter so much. And if we are in the right train, even if we don't have a seat, end up standing, or if we sit facing the wrong direction, or it doesn't really matter so much, we arrive at the correct destination. Now, when we meditate, not just hammering and looking at the meditation object, staying there, sitting longer, and that's all also important, but occasionally, like once in Berlin, we went into one of these, the lift, and then somehow went in the wrong direction, going down rather than up. Just checking when we meditate, the idea is to go up. towards the light should be getting brighter, the mind should be getting brighter and more light. Not going down into the cellar. They don't really have a classic European old-style cellar in Australia. They may have a basement in the new buildings. That's different from a classic English or German cellar. It was an interesting experience bringing up childhood memories, going down into a cellar, and it's always a little bit dark, cool, humid, cool, darkish, maybe a little typical, slightly moldy smell and down. In our meditation, we don't want to go down deeper, pressing the wrong button in the lift, and the mind gets darker, heavier, going down. And whatever the meditation object, whatever technique we are using, just to make sure the white train, just to make sure the lift goes up towards light and freedom, up to the penthouse, on top of the building where I've got all the view. You want to go up and enjoy this bright view when the mind is calm and settled, no one has this open, free view. Or these French monks, good to see, more French monks also coming in. It's up the Tour Eiffel, have the view of Paris. Not down into the deepest dungeons of the Bastille. And we have to check that our meditation goes in the right direction. not just in the formal meditation, all our other activities. The meditation is not just the sitting cross-legged in a formal session, but whatever duties and responsibilities we have in the Sangha, in the monastery. Are we just rushing to finish them, like the people in rush hour? Or are we using that to make the mind lighter and brighter and develop that punya, that good karma that gives us joy and happiness and brightness, which we then also encounter in our formal meditation? Now, all our duties and responsibilities and the way we execute them, the way we practice with them, is that also in the leading towards letting go, freedom, diminishing and ultimately ending dukkha? One interesting thing I encountered traveling, you probably are more familiar than I with that, was people putting these logs, pet logs, onto a bridge, onto the railing. I didn't quite know that, I haven't quite seen that. I had to research then on a search engine, figuring out what they are doing. And I learned that this is like the old one when you put the heart and initials of a couple into the tree, as a sign of everlasting love. So a couple put their initials into this lock and then lock it on some bridge, maybe a famous one, as an expression of their kind of everlasting love. And I was intrigued that people actually really have this aspiration to be fettered, to be locked, to be bound. They actively aspire to that and they symbolize it with a lock. I mean, interpreting the symbol of a lock in a charitable way, maybe one could say it possibly expresses safety or security, but to me a lock is not a very inspiring symbol. It's a symbol of being tied, being fettered, bound. And to actually use that and put that and to aspire to be bound, ideally forever, to another person, to be fettered. And it usually doesn't work out. These locks are also rusting and sometimes people regret it after half a year. Then the lock is still there, but the person or both persons, their feelings have changed. Or even if they're still together. In some places I read, which are famous for doing that, it started creating problems because multiple thousands of locks weigh a lot, and it can be 40, 50 tons. Some authorities were getting concerned about the structural integrity of their bridge, or at least of the railing where they put all these locks, and then they had to start removing them. I found that quite intriguing again as part of that symbol, because we can notice that in our own heart, once we lock ourselves to something, once we fetter ourselves, because it is some force in our heart doing that. It's not just fetter coming from somewhere, but the defilements in our own heart, they are locking us to dukkha. And one can notice the heaviness, a lock is heavy. And the more secure the padlock, and nowadays they steal all these bicycles, and so they drive around with these really heavy padlocks to secure their bike. But the heavier the lock, the stronger the lock, the more securely we latch on, the heavier our heart. These two things, they go together. Latching on, being fettered, and the heart being heavy. If you look at the Maha Satipatthana Sutta, the great discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. Now, the Buddha discusses in detail the Four Noble Truths. And he discusses where does craving arise, where does it manifest, where does it settle down, and in Nivisati, where does it plant itself and settles down, where does it arise? And the answer, whatever in the world is dear to us, whatever is pleasant, whatever is agreeable, enjoyable, fun, this is where craving arises. Upajjati, this is where craving and nivisati finds a foundation, settles in, takes root. And of course, there is a long list of what is pleasant and agreeable and dear in this world, the eye and forms, and so on. But interestingly, it's also craving itself. Craving itself is also dear and agreeable and pleasant, at least from a worldly view. That is why people often try to actively build up craving, just like they actively, deliberately aspire to lock themselves. So we have to be careful that we may actually delight in craving, that deep down we still perceive craving as dear, as pleasant, as agreeable. And this is a great danger because it will undermine our practice. If deep down we actually delight in craving, if deep down we actually want craving because we feel it is dear and agreeable and can give us happiness, if that is deeper down in our mind, then on the not quite so deep level, if we contemplate and practice and try to abandon it, and it will not quite work because deeper down we still have that idea, that craving as agreeable and dear, and that we want more of it, and that undermines all the effort to abandon and reduce craving. On the other hand, if we have that consolation, if we do aim and aspire to abandon craving, if we do have that conviction that we can end craving and that we can experience the and of dukkha, then all the doubting about the minor details is actually not so important anymore. We focus more on the correct direction, and we are much less concerned about the details in our meditation. Another thing I noticed, that as a bhikkhu, one is kind of surrounded in an amazing kind of protective bubble. I mean, even in a monastery, there's no bouncer at the gate of Amaravati. You don't have a bouncer deciding these people can come in and these people can't come in. But amazingly, even without a bouncer, there is a very strong selection process, because the monks, for example, we don't have any money. So anyone who wants money is usually not interested in interacting with us or coming here. Because how can you get money from a bhikkhu who doesn't have any? It's one fascinating, powerful effect of this rule of not owning, using, having money, which is not immediately apparent, but if one reflects on that and observes the effects, it's dramatic. Anyone who is really materialistic, stingy, tight, and after money is usually not interested in a bhikkhu or in a nun with similar precepts. They quickly figure out you can't get that from them. And that means that basically all the people who come to the monastery are rather interested in generosity, in giving, in making good karma, in sharing, in doing acts of kindness. And it's like having a bouncer with psychic powers, because even a good bouncer can't necessarily see that. It would be like a bouncer with psychic powers. Now, the ones who are only into getting stuff, into materialistic, egoistic accumulation, they're not interested in the monastery and the sangha. And all these places usually have, I mean, not completely, but by and large, I have people coming in who are at least generous, and often regularly, very often much more than that, and also interested in precepts, interested in a minimum ethical standard and virtue, interested in increasing knowledge, interested in becoming calm and peaceful, in developing the Dhamma and practicing the Eightfold Path. And this tends to be the people one interacts with all the time. I was fascinated by that. Now, even if you travel, the moment you arrive and someone picks you up in a new city, it may be not the richest person or the most powerful or the most famous or something like that, but it's usually a person who is far beyond average in that location in the qualities that really count, like generosity, kindness, virtue, calm and insight, understanding. Now, sometimes you probably meet some of the best people in that regard, in that whole place. And may meet them straight away at the airport or at the train station, wherever they pick you up. It's amazing, and that follows you as a bhikkhu, as a nun. Wherever you go, you have that. And I even felt one can see that now if I'm in the tube in London, obviously the people around me are not selected like that. And I feel one can see somehow, or sense the difference compared to the people you meet in the Sangha, in the monastery. Having people surrounding us who are sharing what the Buddha called samaditti, the wide view, wholesome view, another view that leads towards ending of dukkha and towards freedom and liberation. Atthi dinang atthi yitang atthi hutang. Now there is giving, there is generosity, there is offerings, there are offerings, there is sacrifice. Now there is doesn't mean just there is, no, but there's a meaning, there's a point to that. It's not in vain to be generous. It has meaning, it's powerful, it is giving results. Ati sukata dukata kammanang palang vipakang. That there is a result of good and bad actions. There actually are good and bad actions. There is good and bad. There is good and evil. There is wholesome and unwholesome. And there are people surrounding us in the Sangha, in a good monastery, who share that outlook on life, who share that view, who have that confidence that good actions, that sacrifice, helping, giving, caring, is not meaningless, but powerful. And giving results, even for many lifetimes, happiness and joy for lifetimes to come. And being surrounded by people with that same outlook almost all the time, compared to this sometimes empty expression you see when people are in rush hour, when they are trying to entertain themselves in big cities with what is on offer there. But very few of what is on offer is actually good and wholesome and giving. Ati mata, ati pita. There is mother and father, and there is something special about mother and father. There is a debt of gratitude. Now, these are people who are not just like everyone, their mother, father. This is someone that we owe our very life, our very body to. I was very happy that my father could join the alms round and put food into the monk's bowl in Mutodaya. Now, they're going I think 5 days a week, not all the monks, but some monks going, and in Kulmbach, in Bayreuth, and in these picturesque German towns, very enjoyable, going alms round. And as they're doing that for 17 years, many people are familiar with the sight of monks and with the lifestyle and what we are doing there. And I was so happy that my father could see that in his natural, in the German environment. He doesn't have this karmic relationship to Asian countries, Asian people like I have. It was great for him that he could experience that, and brought some food, put it in the monk's bowl. Now, there are Samana Brahmana who have truly comprehended this world and I have found the escape, the freedom from suffering, having faith in that, not that wide view. And then readjusting, looking at our meditation, what we're actually doing, looking at our general life as a monk, as a nun, as a lay practitioner, and making sure that our efforts in bhavana are actually leading in that direction, leading towards that freedom. Not so much the details, but making sure that the heart is going up, that the heart is becoming lighter. Whenever we meditate, whenever we work, whenever we do our duties, whenever we develop bhavana, the Eightfold Path, whatever posture, we're checking that the heart doesn't get more heavy, but lighter. The light in both senses of the word. Light in the sense of less dark. The light in the sense of less heavy. If the heart gets dark and heavy, it doesn't matter so much what meditation object we are using or how much we sit or walk or what exactly we do, but it's the wrong direction. And then the main thing is to correct the direction. To do bhavana in such a way that it becomes lighter and less heavy. To do bhavana in such a direction that we are not locking ourselves anywhere, but that we are freeing ourselves from locks. That we are freeing ourselves from craving. Yeah, these are a few reflections I like to share. Thank you for your patience.